This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia says its military hit all the targets in an overnight missile strike on Ukraine after Kiev announced it downed nearly 20 Russian missiles. United Arab Emirates invites Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to attend a UN climate summit in Dubai later this year. And new official data shows unemployment rate in the UK rose in the first 3 months of this year amid a deepening cost of living crisis. And welcome from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Russia says it has hit all the intended targets during its latest overnight strikes on Ukraine.
Last night, the armed forces of the Russian Federation launched a concentrated strike with high-precision long-range air and sea-based weapons at the locations of Ukraine's army units, as well as the storage sites for ammunition, weapons, and military equipment supplied by Western countries. The target of the strike has been achieved. All assigned targets have been hit.
The spokesman said Russian Kinzhal hypersonic missiles also destroyed a U.S. Patriot defense system stationed in Ukraine. Earlier, Ukraine said it shot down 18 Russian missiles, claiming that six of them were hypersonic ones. A Ukrainian military official called Moscow's latest assault exceptional in terms of density. The airstrikes hit the capital, Kiev, and surrounding cities. Meanwhile, six African leaders are to travel to Russia and Ukraine to help find a solution to the war. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says the trip is to be arranged as soon as possible. Both presidents of the warring sides have agreed to receive the mission. Ramaphosa held separate telephone calls with Vladimir Putin and Volodymyr Zelensky over the weekend, presenting an initiative drawn up by Zambia, Senegal, the Republic of Congo, Uganda, Egypt, and South Africa. Meanwhile, a high-level Chinese envoy led by Li Wu is set to begin a trip to Europe that will also take him to Ukraine and Russia. Li served as an ambassador to Russia for 10 years and is assigned with the job of promoting Beijing-led peace negotiations to broker a ceasefire and an end to the fighting in Ukraine. Li will be visiting Ukraine on May the 16th and 17th. Well, we've discussed the recent developments in the Russia-Ukraine war in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Greg Simmons is a researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies in Uppsala, Sweden, who joins us. We also have Glenn Deason, who's a professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway, joining us from Oslo. Welcome to you both. What do you make, Glenn Deason, of the fact that the Ukrainian president has to travel to the UK, for example, and get and make requests for military equipment, which I guess the UK has promised that's going to provide it these long-range missiles, not yet, but in the coming months. But the fact that he has to travel to get the military equipment to Europe, what's your take on it?
Well, I think this is one of Zelensky's strengths. His former profession, obviously being an actor. He's also good at appealing to Western audiences. He's been quite active. The amount of time he spent speaking to various parliaments and Eurovision, like whoever he's speaking to, he's been quite good at reaching out. And this puts pressure on governments also because we've been ramping up this anti-Russian rhetoric for so long that if it comes plea, there's greater pressure, of course, to give weapons. And as Ukraine is preparing this offensive of theirs, they obviously need much more weapon because Russia has profoundly degraded their military capabilities. That is, knocked out a lot of their and most of their air defenses. We've seen over the past two weeks especially, how the weapons depots across Ukraine have been struck. And so I think that they need much more weapons, but also heavier weapons, because in the West there's been some concern about escalating. However, we see now this slow incrementalism where the British, and then probably followed by the French, are prepared to escalate further, because the closer Ukraine comes to a defeat, the more Zelensky will go to these Western capitals and he will receive heavier and heavier weapons with longer range. And this is taking us one step at a time closer effectively to a nuclear exchange.
You know, when we talk about the escalation, it seems like there's no letting up when it comes to either the U.S. or the European support, Greg Simmons, for Ukraine militarily and in terms of, I'm sure, finances also. But I'm wondering what they think when the report just came out that Russian oil exports has reached its highest level since the special military operation, generating the most revenue that it did. Well, this I'm guessing this shows that Russia can continue this war. What are they thinking, you think?
Well, the Europeans do not have any original thoughts of their own. They do whatever Washington tells them. And I mean, this is clear from the very beginning with all these different sanctions and what not to do. I mean, not only are we talking about an increase of these Russian oil exports, but also, I mean, this destruction of their own economies. I mean, you had this stupid comment from Borrell, the originator of this garden concept, who recently said that to block those Indian exports of Russian oil to Europe. So, I mean, they are prepared to destroy themselves for the US, because this is what it's about. This is not about Europe. It's not about Ukraine. It's about US global hegemony.
All right. And finally, the way that this war is progressing, it doesn't seem like either side is going to let up. There's a supposed summer, counteroffensive, if you want to call it, coming from Ukraine. Glenn Deason, what are we looking at where there's a breaking point that may be achieved here, where one or the other side is going to say, okay, enough is enough, and let's get down to talks?
Well, that's the big question, because so far this has become an all-or-nothing war. I mean, for Russia, they consider this to be an existential threat, much like if for the Americans, if the Russians would establish themselves in Mexico, it simply threatens their existence. So they will never be able to step down from this unless they get some deals with NATO. That would be the main thing to negotiate, to have some agreement on ending the NATO expansionism. But beyond that, I think the Ukrainians have also locked themselves, at least Zelensky rhetorically, into no compromise at all. So it's very absolute positions, and the West also doesn't seem willing to let Ukraine fail, hence breaking every red line and being prepared to send heavier and heavier weapons. So I think it will... Well, what we will see in the next few months now is the Ukrainian army suffering immensely and moving towards collapse, at which point in time the West will have a dilemma. Do we send in our own troops? Do we send much more heavy weapon in which we're in a direct war with the Russians? Or do we let Ukraine fail? And I think the problem is, once we actually sit down and negotiate, the question is, what kind of agreement can we actually reach? Because there's no trust on either side. I mean, so I think it's going to go for effectively a military victory at some point.
Okay, thank you for that. Glenn Deason, Professor of Political Science, University of Southeastern Norway. And thank you, Greg Simmons, a researcher at the Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Now, the United Arab Emirates has invited Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to attend a UN climate summit in Dubai later this year. The invitation to the summit comes as the Arab world is gradually warming to Damascus after a long period of cold relations since the 2011 breakout of foreign-led militancy in Syria. The UAE reestablished ties with Syria in 2018. In March of last year, Assad visited the UAE on his first official trip to an Arab country since 2011. He also visited the UAE this year. In March, Saudi Arabia also normalized its ties with Syria. The Arab League has also welcomed back Damascus, whose membership was suspended for more than a decade. Assad has also received an invitation to an Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia scheduled for Friday. Moving on to other news this hour, Israeli forces have carried out fresh violent raids on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The regime's forces stormed the camp in the city of Jenin and detained a Palestinian claiming he had collaborated with resistance fighters. At least three Palestinians were also injured in the attack. The refugee camp has often been targeted under different pretexts. It is home to more than 22,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their ancestral homes by the regime in 1948. Israel has stepped up its attacks on occupied Palestinian towns and cities, killing nearly 120 Palestinians so far this year. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Candil, earlier joined us to give us more details on the latest Israeli raid on Jenin.
The clashes unfortunately led to the injury of three Palestinians. One of them is in serious condition, according to Palestinian paramedics, where the Israeli forces used live fire, of course, against the Palestinians there. The Israelis arrested one Palestinian. They claim that he's responsible for a series of shootings that took place in the last few weeks against Israeli forces and settlers in areas around Jenin. Also, this morning, Israeli forces raided the refugee camp of Aqbat Jaber near Ariha in the Jordan Valley. Clashes erupted between Palestinians and Israeli forces. At least seven Palestinians were detained by the Israeli soldiers from Aqbat Jaber. Palestinian prisoners groups issued a statement saying that at least 25 Palestinians had been arrested by the Israeli forces only this morning in several areas, including Jenin, Aqbat Jaber refugee camp in Ramallah, Nablus, and Bethlehem as well.
Now to the UK, where new data shows an increase in the number of unemployed seeking jobs as Britons are grappling with a painful cost of living crisis. According to the Office for National Statistics, the unemployment rate rose to 3.9% in the first 3 months of 2023. The British economy also witnessed a drop in total payrolled employees between March and April. Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt has expressed worries about difficulty in recruiting employees as well as soaring prices for many people that are dealing with the crisis. The UK economic woes go beyond the problems revolving around the labor force. Now, the value of the British pound against the US dollar has fallen by about 50 basis points and nearly 1.5%. For months, the UK has been reeling from a double-digit inflation and a series of walkouts over pay and working conditions. The EU's spring 2023 economic forecast predicts subdued growth across the 27-country bloc, but suggests that there are mounting risks to financial well-being. The ongoing conflict in Ukraine has again been singled out as a particular concern. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Industrial production in the EU's top economy, Germany, has suffered an unexpected decline. It's bad news for the entire bloc. However, a forecast published on Monday suggests the EU's economy is set to grow modestly. But downside risks are also growing.
Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine continues to cast a long shadow of uncertainty over the economy.
Grants to help struggling EU firms will soon be withdrawn, Eurozone finance ministers announced on Monday.
Companies that are receiving support will have to look at how they can support their own long-term viability.
A growing number of people are reaching the conclusion that the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine through constructive dialogue with Russia. The cost of living crisis resulting from the conflict is taking its toll.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful, but you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Apparently, financial markets are looking on nervously because so many things have been impacted by the war.
Due to the fact also of the uncertainties in China and lower exports and imports from China, and also due to the expectations of the economy in the United States.
A conference in Brussels on Monday heard that cracks are showing in the EU with respect to the war in Ukraine.
The Europeans have been united, but they need to be much more united.
Trade union members across the EU point out that wages are not keeping up with inflation as the bloc continues to spend billions of euro on arming Ukraine. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the role of the Iranian parliament in Iran's foreign policy with the spokesperson for the National Security and Foreign Policy Commission of the Iranian parliament, Dr. Abulfazl Amoui. But first, this brief analysis.
According to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the legislative branch, called the Islamic Shura Majlis, plays an important role in foreign policy and has to ratify any treaty or agreement that creates any obligations or expenditures for Iran. In this context, the Majlis has a supervisory role over the executive branch ministries involved in foreign affairs, particularly the Foreign Ministry, which is legally obligated to report regularly about its activities to the Majlis. Like all executive branch cabinet ministers, the Minister of Foreign Affairs has to be confirmed by the Majlis before taking office and can be removed by the Majlis if deemed not to be performing up to standard. The Majlis also has its own mechanisms of parliamentary diplomacy, a prominent example being the many bilateral parliamentary friendship groups it maintains with other legislative bodies from around the world, as well as diplomacy related to the Islamic and Asian parliamentary unions. As the historic example of the JCPOA and the current examples of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as well as Iran's likely future accession to the BRICS Plus shows, no international agreement is deemed legal under Iranian law until it's confirmed and ratified by the Majlis. This is in contrast to the rubber-stamp parliament that existed during the Pahlavi dynasty, which, despite some members objecting, could not even prevent the British from forcing the ruling monarch of the time to concede any claims to Bahrain during the British retreat from the Persian Gulf in 1971. Bahrain historically being Iranian territory occupied by the British when they entered the Persian Gulf in the early 19th century. Contrary to the distorted picture painted by Iran's enemies, the legislative branch, as the direct representative of a cross-section of Iranian society from all ethnic and regional backgrounds, plays an integral part in the foreign policy decision-making of Iran, and is in fact one of the greatest sources of power and credibility for the Islamic Republic in its defense of Iran's national interests and projection of power around the world, together with the executive branch, the security services, and the Supreme National Security Council. As the global order is rapidly creating new constellations and new alliances, the Islamic Shura Majlis will continue to supervise the activities of the executive branch and defend Iran's national interests as is determined under the Constitution of the Islamic Republic, and will be a source of political power for Iran on the international scene.
Dr. Abulfaz Amoei, spokesperson for the National Security Committee of the Iranian Parliament. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight today. We've come to the Majlis here to speak with you about the role of the Parliament, of the Iranian Parliament, of the Majlis in Iranian foreign policy. As you know, and as our viewers have seen, we have done a series of programs with the different members of the foreign policy team as it relates to the foreign ministry. Today we thought it might be good to look at these issues from the perspective of the parliament. So we were talking a little bit about the examples. We mentioned the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS, the issues related to the dollar. But we also were also referencing very briefly the issue of the JCPOA and the ongoing nuclear talks. I don't know if we can even call it the JCPOA anymore, whatever it is, whatever you want to call it. And we had this very interesting thing that was mentioned in this process by the foreign minister, saying that there's a limited time that this can go on like this, the way it's been going, and the Americans not really responding in any reasonable way or in any kind of effective way to the efforts that are being made by Iran to come to an agreement. If you could please first give us a little bit of that historic background of how the Majlis was involved in the JCPOA process when it was ratified by the parliament. Later on, we saw again with the law that related to the nuclear capabilities of the country, the Majlis entering the scene, telling the government that it has to defend Iran's nuclear rights, but within the JCPOA. And now, finally, we've come to this point where it seems to be that these talks are not really getting anywhere. So if you could please give us, from the perspective of the Majlis, a little insight into this issue.
خب موضوع برجام و توافق سال 2015.
Well, the issue of the JCPOA and the 2015 nuclear deal is an issue related to the previous parliament. It has been examined in the previous parliament at the time when a deal was reached between our government and the P5+1 group. This agreement is in the form of a joint program. In fact, it is not an international agreement. It is not a treaty, but it is done as a joint program between the parties. But because it could create commitments for our country, the parliament got involved in it, established a special commission, held special and complex meetings for it, and finally the previous parliament approved a law It allowed the government with 9 conditions to carry out this joint program by pursuing Iran's national interests and take its implementation steps. Of course, other conditions were added by the leader of the Islamic Republic, and they were very important conditions, and thus the JCPOA was approved by the Iranian parliament for implementation. During the implementation of the JCPOA, from the very beginning, we witnessed the other parties' breaches. They violated their own commitments, whether in the Obama era or even more so in the Trump era. This was from the American side. Finally, Trump withdrew from this agreement in 2018 and dealt a blow to the implementation of the deal. And not only did he return the previous sanctions, but during the previous period when Trump was in power, he added maybe twice as many sanctions on Iran. And apart from the fact that the U.S. government itself did not fulfill its obligations, it prevented others who were members of the agreement from implementing their obligations, and so they too started violating them. The European side entered into a dialogue with us in 2018 and announced that we can follow up on this commitment in the form of the 4+1 without America. And again, the negotiations that took place between Iran and Europe, the European side gave us 11 commitments, which the introduction of implementing them was establishing an institution called INSTEX, which can be a financial settlement institution between Iran and Europe. But we witnessed that they delayed both in implementing this structure, and ultimately it was inefficient until they announced in recent days that they will dissolve this institution. And consequently, the 11 commitments which the Europeans gave were not implemented either. Concurrently, we witnessed the change of the parliament in Iran. The 11th parliament came, and it had a different political view than the previous one. And at the beginning of its work, due to the sensitivity of the nuclear issue, this parliament introduced a roadmap in the form of a law, and that law is a well-known law called the Strategic Action Plan to Lift Sanctions. The parliament designed a path and announced its demand to the government that the government should move in that direction. The key point was that the parliament announced in this framework that since the other party has not fulfilled its commitments, Iran should also stop the voluntary implementation of its commitments. Part of it was that we removed restrictions on the enrichment process and the enriched uranium stockpile in the parliament's law. Likewise, we said in a few months that if the other side does not take a step to lift the sanctions, Iran should no longer accept extra safeguard inspections, and the government institutions are not allowed to implement them. In fact, according to this law, the parliament took back part of the permits the previous parliament had given to the government to fulfill its obligations. And accordingly, surveillance beyond safeguards is against the law in Iran, and this is being followed up by our government. At the same time, the parliament followed the government to discuss the nuclear negotiations in order to pursue the rights of the Iranian people. We had unilaterally fulfilled our obligations based on 15 reports by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. But it was the other side that had violated these commitments. And today, after a long period of time, the parliament came to the conclusion that it should not accept a commitment unilaterally, and this is of no use. And this strategic action plan is still our roadmap in the 11th legislature. And that is why, during the nuclear negotiations that took place in Vienna, or whatever stage it reaches, the parliament invites the negotiating team or the foreign minister, hears the report of that meeting, and gives its opinion. That is, it follows up in the National Security Commission. Or regarding the cooperation between Iran and the agency on the surveillance issue, we have this meeting with the head of the Atomic Energy Organization and his deputies, and we will talk about what agreements they have made. We hear the details of it. We listen to their expert opinions. And at the same time, we follow up on its compliance with our own laws and the opinions of the parliament. Currently, the negotiation process is moving slowly. Since September, the other side has been slowing down the process of negotiations due to its own internal elections. And after what may have been a miscalculation regarding Iran's internal developments, and cannot reach a conclusion. The text of the agreement is almost ready, according to the reports we have received. It is a joint decision by the Joint Commission of Iran and 4+1, based on which the U.S. can become a member of the P5+1 group again by fulfilling certain conditions. Currently, this agreement exists between Iran and the 4+1 group, and Iran's compensatory measures are based on this agreement, paragraph 26 of the JCPOA. But we took compensatory measures because the other party fulfilled its obligations. The original agreement is available, and it is the American side that, with the change of government, even though they confirmed the policy of maximum pressure failed, they will return to the agreement. Well, the Americans cannot return to the agreement without fulfilling their obligations, and this is the subject of negotiations for the past 1.5 years. The Americans resisted every step to lift any sanctions, and this has caused the negotiations to be prolonged. Otherwise, the Islamic Republic's position was the same in the beginning, and it's still the same, that if the Americans accept all their commitments, after we verify the sanctions have been lifted, Iran will return its compensatory measures to the level within the limits of the JCPOA. This is the negotiation process. But the other party has made political mistakes in the negotiating process. For instance, they kept waiting due to the elections and internal developments. Your audience knows that the internal situation is like in America, the extreme bipolarity that exists there, and they turn every issue into a political issue. This is not our concern as the opposing country, but it is the other side that has to solve its internal issues behind the door of the negotiating room, and after that, enter the negotiations. We face the obligations of the U.S. government, not the Democrats or the Republicans. But beyond this, it was an internal discussion, and perhaps they were facing a miscalculation with regard to Iran's internal developments. After September, there were protests in Iran after the death of Mrs. Amini, and the anti-Iranian groups must have tried to turn these protests into chaos and create disorder and disturbance in public security. Perhaps the Americans came to the analysis that Iran may desist from its main positions in the nuclear issue due to its own internal issues. But this was an incorrect calculation. We announced to the other party during those developments through the exchange of non-papers that we will not give up on our positions. These developments are the developments that the people themselves quickly helped to return public security to the country, and that happened. This year, we had one of the most glorious rallies on the 22nd of Bahman, the anniversary of the revolution, by the people, which was a clear international message that sovereignty in Iran, public security, and public order has the maximum support in Iran. At the same time, this slowness still exists on the other side, but Iran has not stopped on the issue of nuclear negotiations. With our president's trip to China, we have the suggestion of enhancing cooperation with China on the agenda. Finding new business partners is one of our priorities, while we demand the lifting of sanctions against our country. The issue of sanctions is not an issue that will stop Iran. The parliament also requests reports from the authorities of our government at any level during the process of nuclear negotiations. It listens to their opinions, and if it has any opinion, it implements it. And in this framework, our main agenda is the strategic action plan to lift sanctions.
Very good, Doctor. We had this very, how should I call it, this kind of strategic surprise for a lot of people in the world, the agreement that happened between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Contrary to the belief of many that this could never happen or that these two are never capable of coming to some sort of an agreement, of course, with the help of the Chinese government. Of course, this was done on the part of the National Security Council and Dr. Shamkhani, who did that, which is a little bit different than if the foreign ministry had done that. Of course, the foreign ministry and other organizations, security organizations, were involved in these discussions. But just in terms of the significance of this agreement, and also, once again, the Majlis's
view and position on this agreement. If you could please give us a little insight and analysis, your analysis of how you see this agreement that has now happened between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
The parliament and the people's representatives pay a lot of attention to our relations with our neighbors. Some of the representatives are from the cities that are located in the borders of our neighboring countries. Therefore, they receive well the issue of strengthening relations with the neighbors, which is now one of the approaches and instructions of the government. In the case of Saudi Arabia, the Islamic Republic considers Saudi Arabia as an important country in the Islamic world, and our relationship with Saudi Arabia was not cut off by Iran, but it was Saudi Arabia that severed ties following some issues about the embassy and arguments before that. From the moment that some parties mediated, the Islamic Republic had announced that we are ready to restore bilateral ties with the Saudi government. But it was the other side that had some ambiguities and wanted to present conditions or to hear some issues in this regard. The Iraqi side, Mr. Al-Kadhimi government, entered as a mediator, and five rounds of security negotiations were held in Iraq with the presence of the deputy of the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Mr. Shamkhani's deputy, and also security negotiations were held in Muscat. And finally, with a change in the government, there was a little gap in the conclusion of these negotiations, and it was the Chinese side that followed up on this issue and tried to bring these negotiations to a conclusion. Well, we have friendly relations with China. We also welcome the principle of relations with Saudi Arabia. Of course, this does not mean that we do not have difference of opinion with Saudi Arabia. We have differences of opinion on some regional issues. But with due respect to the Saudi government, we have different opinions, but we do not consider it as a negation of bilateral relations. On the contrary, we think that we can raise these differences explicitly in bilateral relations and finally reach a common solution that is in the interest of the Islamic world. In this way, negotiations were held with the mediation and suggestion of the Chinese side at a high level, and Mr. Shamkhani, in a five-day trip, met with his Saudi counterpart in Beijing, and they reached a document, and a statement was published that the two sides will move towards meeting with the foreign ministers as the ones who will follow up on this process and revive the activities of embassies in Tehran and Riyadh within a span of 2 months. Well, the initial steps have been taken. Our foreign ministers will meet soon, and after that, it seems that delegations will be exchanged. The discussion of reopening the embassies will probably be resumed soon. We consider this an achievement for the entire Islamic world because we think that the issues related to the Muslims could be brought up amongst each other. At the same time, we think that the interests of the Muslim people should be taken into consideration everywhere. China's role in this agreement was very important. China appeared as an influential actor in the West Asian region, where the Americans think they are the decisive player, and the reflection of China's role in this agreement within America in the American think tanks was extraordinary, and many considered it as America's weakness and its inability to create stability in the West Asian region and the Persian Gulf. Thus, China followed a relatively higher role than acting in these issues. But from the perspective of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we think that expanding relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia can include the general interests of the Islamic world. The different issues that exist between us, from permanent religious cooperation, such as the issue of the Hajj, which is done naturally, to the development of cooperation at the economic level and the creation of a joint cooperation in the field of oil export, OPEC and OPEC Plus, are among the interesting topics that can be pursued. People's cooperation, such as consular relations, is an important topic that should be considered for the nationals of both sides. On the part of Saudi Arabia, I think different analyses were presented by the media and prominent personalities. The Saudi government has taken steps for stability in the region with this move, and I believe that by continuing this path, we can reach the vision of a united Islamic front against the Zionists. The Zionists are the party that tries to sow the seeds of animosity in the Islamic countries in order for itself to survive, to create an opportunity in some Arab countries by creating a negative space for Iran or by harming the interests of Iran. They can put on a show. But the truth is that the Zionists are not accepted among the people of the region. Not only among the people of the region, but today they are also faced with a great internal challenge, which requires a plan to return them to the source of this oppression. That is, the occupation of a land that has original owners is the basis for the formation of this wrong existence, which ultimately has led to the formation of the Zionist regime, which we think is a false structure with weak foundations that will not last long.
Dr. Amri, we've come to the end of the program. We have maybe 1 or 2 minutes left. If there's anything else you need feel that you should mention about these issues, please go ahead. We have a few minutes.
Thank you for providing me with this opportunity. Politics in Iran has an active dynamism, which means that the parliament has serious discussions, opposes and approves, and the parliament, the government, and other forces have different opinions. Those who want to analyze and evaluate Iran must seriously consider this dynamic and the activity of different views inside Iran. At the same time, our effort in the governance of Iran is that this exchange of opinions and this exchange of views will lead to a single approach and strategy, which will ultimately be seen as Iran's foreign policy. Thank you.
Dr. Amri, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Amri? As the global order is changing, the world is entering a new era with new alliances being formed. And Iran is going to be dealing with a myriad of new opportunities and challenges. This requires the effective coordination of the different organizations tasked in Iran with conducting international relations, such as the Supreme National Security Council, the Foreign Ministry, the Security Services, and of course the Islamic Shura Majlis, which under the Constitution supervises the activities of the executive branch and without whose ratification no treaty or agreement is deemed legal under the law. As happened after the foolish U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, when the Majlis entered the scene and passed legislation to defend Iran's nuclear technology and industry in the face of Western noncompliance, so today the Majlis is warning the U.S. that Iran will not wait forever for the U.S. and Europe to make a decision about the ongoing sanctions relief and nuclear talks in Vienna. The Majlis is also seriously pursuing its constitutional duty as it relates to Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as well as BRICS Plus, as well as Iran's recent agreement with Saudi Arabia, and in general, all the supervisory and legislative aspects related to Iran's growing relations with its neighbors and regional and global partners. The Majlis is also finally getting serious about the de-dollarization of Iran's global trade, particularly after the dollar was used by Iran's enemies to cause economic destabilization after the failed color revolution of this year, and after repeated warnings by the leader of the Islamic Revolution to end the era of the dollar in the Iranian economy. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In the previous edition of the program, we had a look at the different parts, different phrases of Kumail supplication in details. In this edition, however, we will have a look at the general frame of supplication of Kumail. Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, we had a quick summary of the structure of this holy supplication of Kumail, but there seems to be a further need for explanation and elaboration. Because, as we said, there are four means of recourse in the supplication of Kumail, and we will now talk in details about these four means of recourse which have appeared in this supplication and which actually constitute the second part of it, as we mentioned earlier. So, the first means is Allah's previous goodness, His previous birr and kindness and grace toward His servants. Should there be any shortcoming and flaw in the action and endeavor of a person which keeps him away from Allah, then Allah's previous grace and mercy toward him would intercede with him on his behalf. His previous grace and mercy towards His servants affirms His love and hope for them. This divine love is a means of recourse that one sends forth before seeking His needs from Allah, the Exalted. In case a servant does not deserve Allah's mercy, then His love, subhanahu wa ta'ala, toward him would qualify him to attain His mercy and grace, and would place the servant in the position of being answered.
Allahumma inni as'aluka.
Allahumma inni as'aluka
bi rahmatika allati wasi'at kull shay.
Allahumma inni as'aluka bi rahmatika allati wasi'at kull shay.
Wa bi jabarutika allati خلقت بها كل شيء
وبجبروتك التي خلقت بها كل شيء
يا نور يا قدوس يا نور يا قدوس يا نور يا قدوس يا نور يا قدوس
يا أول
Imam alayhi salam says in this regard, O you who gave rise to my creation, to the remembrance of me, to the nurture of me, to the goodness toward me, bestow upon me for the sake of your having given rise to me with generosity and your previous goodness to me. He, the Exalted, began first with our creation, our khalq, our remembrance and dhikr, our nourishment, and showed goodness and birr toward us before we even asked Him for that, and without we deserving this goodness and remembrance from Him. If this is the case, then He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, is more entitled to do good to us
and honor us if we are to pray to him and ask from him for all this. And if our wrongdoings and sins obstruct his goodness and mercy, then his love for us would indeed mediate between him and us and make us subject to his kindness and mercy. The second means, dear listeners, is our love for him. So the first means was his previous goodness and kindness and grace towards his servants. But the second means is our love for him. In the first means, the Imam alayhi salam sought recourse to Allah with his love for us, and thereafter seeks recourse to him with our love for him. And this is as effective a means as his love for us. This is because the element of love has a great value, and nothing can equal it in the eyes of the beloved. However much we may doubt in our love for something, we cannot doubt in our love for Allah, for his friends and awliya. Love is a commodity that Allah the Exalted never rejects. Love is a commodity which Allah the Exalted never ever rejects. Parallel to this means is our profession of his oneness, our humility before him, our prayers, our prostration, our remembrance of him, and our testimony that he is our Lord, that he is the one who has created us, he is the absolute cause, and he is our Rabb, and we are his servants. However, all these can be summarized in two things: our love for him and our profession of his oneness, his tawheed. And we are confident that love and oneness are two commodities that would never be rejected by Allah, the two things we can never doubt even for a moment. So, seeking recourse to Allah with this means, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Can you see yourself tormenting me with your fire after I have professed to your unity? After your knowledge my heart has embraced, your remembrance my tongue has constantly mentioned, your love to which my mind has clung, and after the sincerity of my confession and my supplication humble before your lordship?" Dear listeners, this is what Imam Ali alayhi salam says regarding the second means of recourse to the Almighty Allah. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies: Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.